Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Professor Alexander Nemirov for Outlandish Life, Peter Paul Rubens and the Baroque, exploring the dramatic art of the 17th century. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
Hey y'all, I'm Sam Sanders. Today on my show with KCRW, legendary Hollywood costume designer Ruth E. Carter. Ruth has been making looks for Hollywood for decades. She costume designed iconic films like Malcolm X, Do the Right Thing, Black Panther, and most recently, Sinners. She is also the only black woman to have won 2 Academy Awards. And she's not stopping now.
I mean, when I walk into any big department store here in L.A. and I see, you know, a young black girl in there pulling for her show, I feel like I've had something to do with that. And I'm welcoming that.
Costume designer Ruth E. Carter on Building Black Hollywood. Plus, will AI ever make good music? All that coming up this hour after these headlines.
Live from NPR News, I'm Janine Herbst. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says officials are reviewing the video of a September 2nd strike against an alleged drug boat near Venezuela to determine if it will be made public. NPR's Joe Hernandez reports this comes as lawmakers continue to raise questions about the U.S. military attacking survivors of the initial strike.
Democratic lawmakers and others have criticized the September 2nd strike after it was revealed that the military fired on survivors of an initial attack. Congressman Jim Himes, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, told CBS's Face the Nation that the footage should be made public.
These guys, and this is why the American people need to see this video, these guys were barely alive, much less engaging in hostilities.
Defense Secretary Hegseth has said he authorized the initial strike, but that a military commander approved the follow-up attack. Hegseth has not committed to releasing the full video, saying on Friday that officials were trying to determine whether doing so would endanger ongoing operations. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
Elon Musk's X has kicked the European Commission out of a key system for buying and tracking ads. NPR's Bobby Allen has more.
Musk's X announced it had terminated the European Commission's access to its ad system, accusing EU officials of abusing an ad tool to boost a post about its hefty fine against Musk. It comes just days after the Commission fined X for issues including deceptive design practices over its paid blue check feature. It allows anyone to pay for so-called verification. EU regulators said that exposes users to scams, manipulation, and the spread of misleading content. Since the fine, Vice President J.D. Vance has attacked the move as punishing Musk for not engaging in censorship sought by European regulators. Europe's crackdown on X and other social media sites has reignited tensions with Washington over the future of free speech online. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
In Bethlehem, families gathered to watch the lighting of a Christmas tree yesterday for the first time in 2 years. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi reports.
Hundreds of people gathered in Manger Square in Bethlehem near the site where Christians believe Jesus was born. A prayer was read and cheers broke out as people stood around the giant Christmas tree. Bethlehem Mayor Maher Qanawati spoke. We will raise our voices with a message of peace that comes from the pain we experience, he said. Since the war in Gaza broke out, the Israeli military has ramped up its operations in the West Bank and restricted movement, contributing to a fall in tourism in Bethlehem. According to the local government, unemployment rose from 14% to 65%. Today, there is cautious hope that the new year will bring peace. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
And the city's hoping to bring back tourism that was lost during the war. You're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Rachel Vasquez. Transit advocates in San Francisco are rallying support for a local parcel tax measure that would help fund Muni. SFMTA is facing a more than $300 million budget deficit, and advocates say this progressive tax, which they've dubbed the Muni Forever proposal, would help fill the gap. Shia French is with Senior and Disability Action, which is helping promote the measure.
The service we have right now is not enough. And also, when we go to voters, we need to be saying, if you vote for this, things will improve, not things will be worse.
French says the effort would work in tandem with a separate proposed regional tax measure in order to avoid transit service cuts across the Bay Area. Supporters plan to rally tomorrow in front of San Francisco City Hall. UC Berkeley is launching a first-of-its-kind initiative to close the gap in medical research between male and female athletes. The Women's Health and Performance Initiative will use AI and data from UC Berkeley athletes to build health models specifically for women. Former UC President Janet Napolitano is leading the project. She says using male data for female bodies creates risks, not just on the field, but also in national defense.
So as we improve health outcomes through this initiative for female athletes, we can apply lessons learned or new technology created or new tools developed to the health outcomes of women who have chosen to protect the nation.
Napolitano says less than 10% of sports medicine research now is focused exclusively on women. I'm Rachel Vasquez, KQED News.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. And support comes from you, the listeners and supporters and members of KQED. Have you tried our crossword puzzles? Clues this week include big name and pineapples and type of chance with little chance. Find the latest puzzle at kqed.org/crossword. Very chilly day today. High just 54 degrees in San Francisco right now, 53 degrees in the Napa Valley. It's 55 in Sonoma County, and the warm spot is Santa Cruz at 63 degrees with lots of hazy sunshine. 6.5 minutes past three.
Hey y'all, it's the Sam Sanders Show from KCRW, here with big questions and hot takes on the pop culture we love. Thank you so much for listening to my show. This week, I'll be speaking with legendary Hollywood costume designer Ruth E. Carter. Ruth is the visionary behind the look of films like Black Panther and most recently, Sinners. Ruth is also the only black woman to have won 2 Academy Awards. And she is not stopping now.
I mean, when I walk into studio services at any big department store here in L.A. and I see, you know, a young black girl in there pulling for her show, I feel like I've had something to do with that. And I'm welcoming that because, you know, there's room for all of us. There's room for all of them. Why wouldn't there be room for all of us?
Yes. But first in this episode, we got a segment all about music. And to start that one off, I want to play a little song.
Hey, 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 it's that season again.
Hey, hey.
Not just joy, not just cheer. Let's bring some soul to the world.
A Soul to the World by a Christian recording artist named Solomon Ray. Catchy, no? So late last month, Solomon Ray became the number one artist on iTunes' Top 100 Christian and Gospel Albums chart. It's a big deal. Christianity Today even covered this story with the following headline. Quote, the current number one Christian artist has no soul. Yeah, they said this guy has no soul because Solomon Ray is not a real person at all. Solomon Ray is AI generated. I keep seeing stories like this. More and more AI artists making more and more AI music that's getting more and more popular. I wanted to figure out just how scared of this stuff I should be, so I called up Andrew R. Chow, tech correspondent for Time Magazine. Let's get into it. Andrew, hi, how are you?
Sam, it's great to be here.
It's good to have you. I have been obsessed with AI music for some time, and I'm so happy to talk with you about it because I have so many questions. What's going on with this guy, Solomon Ray?
So, Sam, I'm so glad that we're talking about this right now because I've been looking at and studying AI music for the last few years, since 2020, but I would say over the last 2 months has really been this sort of tidal wave of AI artists and or musicians using AI just catapulting up the charts. And it's not just one artist, and it's not just one chart, it's not just one genre. It's happening across the board in these really strange ways where all of these AI songs are going really viral. And Solomon Ray is one of these artists that is making a lot of waves. It's making a lot of people happy. It's making a lot of people really mad, because you would think that maybe gospel would be the furthest thing from AI music, right?
Yes, because gospel needs soul.
Gospel needs heart.
It needs deep emotion.
It's the idea of gospel being that you're in a community and the Spirit moves you, and, you know, it's so grounded in, you know, lived experiences, and then you channel the Spirit through your song. But Solomon Ray is not a real person. It's an AI creation. Although, you know, the bio for Solomon Ray is a Mississippi-made soul singer carrying a Southern soul revival into the present. Yes. but in reality...
Also, I looked him up. He's like, he's handsome.
Yes.
He's well-dressed.
He's very well-dressed.
Distinguished-looking black man. I'm like, oh, I would like go to Solomon's church.
He's got a little bit of a Jidenna vibe. He's got, like, he's all spiffed up. But he's really the creation of this hip-hop artist named Christopher Townsend, who is a sort of a MAGA conservative hip-hop artist involved with Veterans for Trump. It's, from what I understand, it's a black MAGA guy who decided to create this sort of, like, avatar for himself, or this sort of alter ego that he can channel his, you know, his conservative gospel bent. And these days, so there have been a few different applications, one of the biggest one I think being Suno, where you can basically, it's just like ChatGPT, but it's music. You put in a prompt and say, like, hey, I have these lyrics and I want it to sound like a gospel song, like a fiery gospel song with a lot of heart and maybe some nice guitar and nice piano. And you put it into Suno and it will spit out a song. And then you can say, like, hey, maybe, like, I want it in a lower register, or, hey, I want a female voice. I want a scratchier voice, or, oh, I want it in a different tempo. And it can spit out a bunch of different versions for you. And at the moment, 7 million songs are created on Suno every single day. So it's this platform where people who basically have no knowledge or expertise of music are able to create music really, really fast and based on just text prompts.
I'm going to tell you what I'm doing right now. I'm typing in to Suno, Patti LaBelle Christmas Anthem Funk. Because I love Miss Patti.
Absolutely. Now, the first thing you might run into is the copyright issue around the name Patti LaBelle. So, and this is sort of a rabbit hole that maybe we don't want to get into immediately. But these sites, you know, they're not supposed to train on real singers without the consent of singers, because obviously it's like this sort of Ursula and Ariel type thing. They're stealing the voices of real musicians. That has not stopped the output of these AI things from sounding exactly like a Patti LaBelle or somebody like that.
Yeah. Well, and this is my question with all this, because, you know, we began talking about Solomon Ray, this made up artist, but there are other AI artists who are making music that's charting that end up getting complaints from actual singers who say, hold up, this sounds way too much like me. And from my understanding, all AI is just slurping up what already exists. So it's always playing off of someone's already existing voice, no?
Companies don't want to say that, but I think it's like very evidently true that the way that these systems train is on the existing corpus of music. And they can say like, oh, well, we found, you know, some, I guess, like public libraries of things. They train on Creative Commons type libraries. But you will get these situations where a voice sounds basically exactly like a very famous person. So there are two examples that went viral recently. The first one, there was this big country song called Walk My Walk by an AI artist called Breaking Rust that made a lot of headlines.
Stop right there. Breaking Rust. So dramatic.
So dramatic.
I love it.
You can hate my style, you can roll your eyes, but I ain't slowing down. I was born to rise, so kick them right.
box. If you don't like how I talk, I'm gonna keep on talking and walk my walk.
This also went to number one for a second, no?
So
on like one chart.
It went to number one on basically a fake chart that's very easy to manipulate. It was like the country music digital sales chart, which who buys songs on iTunes anymore? Like, do you know anybody who buys, like, goes to iTunes and buys a song for a dollar?
To any listeners who do that, we respect you. We know your few, though. We know your few.
I've talked to experts who say it only takes about maybe 3,000 to 5,000 purchases to get to number one in that chart, which means that, you know, you artists pay $5,000 for, you know, a marketing campaign all the time. So regardless of what happened there, this country singer, quote unquote, called Breaking Russ went to number one on the country digital sales chart. And he sounds suspiciously like Blanco Brown. Well, I don't know if you remember, he had this big viral song called The Get Up a few years ago. He's a black country artist who sort of incorporated some hip hop into his style. It was at a time when we all thought maybe country music was opening the door to black music. It didn't really in a big way.
Yeah.
but this singer who has sort of a white avatar, Breaking Rust, sounds very much like Blanco Brown in sort of the huskiness of his voice.
Take it to the left now and dip with it. Don't throw down. Take a sip with it. Now lean back. Put your hips in it. Let's have some fun.
Blanco Brown said that he got a ton of texts when the song went viral, being like, hey, I didn't know you made this song.
Wow.
It was not him. So, yes, the Blanco Brownness of his quality, for whatever however it happened, seeped its way into this model.
Yeah. And then there was another one that I heard about, an artist I've known for years who spoke up pretty publicly about a viral TikTok song that sounded way too much like her, right?
Yes. So the artist that you're talking about is Kehlani. And the song that you're talking about, or the artist that you're talking about, her name is Zania Monet.
You kept showing love even when they switched. Kept walking light when life got dark quick. You poured into others while running on E. But baby, breakthrough coming, just wait and see. You ain't crazy.
She's an AI creation.
She is an AI creation. Now, apologies, I'm jumping around a lot because I think this one is actually really interesting because Zania Monet is an AI creation, but it's made by a single black woman named Talisha Nikki Jones, who is a Mississippi poet. And what Talisha says is that she is a poet. She writes all of her lyrics, but she cannot sing. So she uses these AI services. She basically puts in her lyrics and it creates songs based on these lyrics and that are very deeply personal to her. For instance, she sings about losing her dad and not having father figures or strong male presences in her life, and that she can channel her creativity through this AI. And now through this persona named Zania, who like can belt like no other, and Zania Monet was now signed, which is crazy. But Kehlani saw that and basically said, miss me with this. You know, like, I will never respect AI art because they didn't put in the work. They didn't put in the vocal training or the lessons.
Yeah.
They didn't have to practice singing for crowds. And it's just this, like, huge shortcut to be able to creating music.
When someone like Kehlani, who was an established, actual, real-life human R&B artist, pushes back against an AI song, an artist who sounds too much like her, what is their actual recourse besides just complaining?
Yes. So now we get into the business side of this. And by the way, there are so many real artists who are complaining and speaking out viciously. Dolly Parton called AI the mark of the beast, which I just think is such a Dolly phrase.
Yes.
And for a while, the main like studios, the labels were fighting back because they felt like their output was being stolen by these AI companies. So they were throwing all these lawsuits at these AI startups. But over the last year, something has changed. And now a lot of labels are actually partnering with the same startups that they sued.
What?
So Warner Music Group sued Suno. And now is in business with Suno. And
are you serious?
Three major labels recently licensed their catalogs to this AI startup called Clay. which allows users to adjust songs using AI. And their, you know, their CEO said they wanted to, quote unquote, reimagine listening, which I have no idea what that means.
Whoa.
So for whatever reason, these major labels went from being very threatened to now seeing some sort of business opportunity. And
yeah.
That is going to make it really hard for the artists inside of the labels to find recourse.
Yeah. How do the artists feel about this? Like, if you're an artist signed to a label, you probably don't have any right once you sign the contract to fight your record label from partnering up with some AI music group. Can the artist do anything? It's like they're outnumbered. The label wants the AI music. The AI companies work with the labels. The artists are just stuck in this predicament.
And this has been, you know, a big predicament for the battle between artists and labels since the beginning of time, you know, like immortalizing Dreamgirls and all of that. And this is just sort of the latest extension of this fight. It's really difficult to say how much recourse artists are going to get if there's an opt-in or opt-out, when they're going to be able to say, like, no, I don't want my voice to be used. Again, this is all piling up in the last month or so, which is just so remarkable.
I want to stop you there and ask why you think it's happening right now.
It's a great question, and I think it's a combination of things. One is that the technology has gotten really good in the past year, and all mm-hmm. these users are just figuring out how to use these tools like Suno and then make mm-hmm. sort of quality grade or like believably realistic songs that then make their way onto TikTok, and a lot of people can't tell the difference at all. There have been studies which say that, you know, a vast majority of listeners cannot tell the difference between AI music and real music. So that's the first thing.
Yeah.
The quality of AI has gotten sadly, really good in the last year. The second is, I guess, the virality factor and the sort of heightened cultural atmosphere with which this music is entering the discourse, because there are so many people who have this visceral disgust and a hate of AI right now. It's in the news. So anything like related to headlines like, oh, AI music, especially gospel AI country AI, that's going to piss a lot of people off. It's going to create headlines and then just create this flywheel effect where people are hate listening and love listening to it.
Yeah. 2025 has very much felt like the year in which we all decided, for better or worse, to never stop talking about AI. I am seeing countless headlines and I've been in countless conversations about the rise of AI slop. I'm in LA. Everyone is talking about how AI is going to kill the TV and film industry. And now it's in music as well. Does 2025 and the conversation around AI maybe mark a turning point? Are we really going to pick up our digital pitchforks in all of this, or is it just kind of a fad, this outrage?
I think 2025 marks a huge turning point for AI, in which maybe before it really felt like AI was being pushed upon us by a couple of billionaires who really wanted us to use it. And that may still mm-hmm. be the case in 2025. But I think the main difference, and especially when we look at a lot of this music, is it is being created by these small artists. It's not like this top-down thing where an executive is like, hey, use this tool. It's these, you know, it's this Mississippi poet, and it's these artists who are saying like, hey, I want to use AI for this thing. And then they're finding viral success for whatever reason. So I think there's a lot of outrage right now. I think the outrage will continue because there's something so unsettling about wanting to turn to an AI voice for some sort of spiritual awakening or satisfaction. But the fact is that it's like sort of the technology is good enough that it's worked its way into the cultural bloodstream and social media that it's really going to be hard to dislodge going forward.
Yeah. Andrew, thank you so much. I will send you my AI generated Patti LaBelle Christmas anthem funk very soon.
Please don't.
All right, time for a break. When we come back, my conversation with pioneering costume designer Ruth E. Carter. Ruth tells me how she got into costume design and what went into designing the looks for one of this year's biggest and best looking movies, Sinners. Stick around.
Support for KQED comes from Second Harvest of Silicon Valley, providing nutritious food to 1 in 6 people in Santa Clara and San Mateo counties. Learn more at shfb.org. And European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com. Well, this holiday season is here, and we want to know how you celebrate. Are you doing anything different this year? Maybe making a new dish, visiting a new place? You can share your stories with KQED's Perspectives. Visit kqed.org/perspectives to submit your piece today and check it out. Let's take a look at what's coming up on Planet Money and How I Built This. That's at 9 o'clock this evening.
On the next Planet Money, tariffs. We ask, are they hiking prices yet?
Yeah, there's clear evidence that the tariffs have affected the prices of many goods.
And on How I Built This, two early-stage founders get some timely business advice from host Guy Raz and Chet Pipkin, founder of Belkin. That's on the next Planet Money and How I Built This from NPR.
Planet Money and How I Built This at its new time at 9 o'clock Sunday evening. Sam Sanders coming your way and continuing actually at 3 every Sunday.
Hey, y'all. It's the Sam Sanders Show from KCRW. So I record a lot of these episodes in a studio. A studio that we have decorated as best we can on a public radio budget. My guest this episode, she really liked our studio setup.
I feel like I'm in Naples, Italy.
Y'all hear that? Y'all hear that? This guest also came dressed to the nines for our conversation.
You know, this set is just so extraordinary. I just was like, I have to bring some color.
We love it. She wore this incredible bright pink pantsuit with oversized shoulders. These epic blood red platform heels, hands down best dressed guest we have ever had. It makes sense once you learn what she does for a living. I'm talking about Ruth E. Carter, two-time Academy Award winning costume designer, making people look good on sets and in studios, especially black people. That's her job. Ruth did the costuming for both Black Panthers, for Malcolm X, and most recently for Sinners, one of the biggest movies of 2025. I talk with Ruth about how she does it, why she does it, and how the magical world of movie costuming can inform how we dress ourselves in real life every day. I absolutely love this chat. I think you will too. Let's get into it. I was reading up on your experience with Sinners, and you said in one interview that this was your first horror movie?
Yeah, it was. I had to keep reminding myself I was doing a horror picture because I was more into like the period picture and how to tell this story of the Great Migration and who's at the train station, you know, like where are we in time and and how do these people express themselves through their clothing?
Yeah.
You know, what don't they have? What, you know, how do they make something out of nothing? Some people may have made their dress to go to the gym. I was totally into that part.
Yeah.
And then here comes the blood. And I was like, wait, you're going to put blood on that dress?
This beautiful dress that I just designed. You're going to put blood on it?
So my aging and dying team, led by Sharon Flavelle, they really took their time and told the story of what aging would look like. We didn't want to just be kind of a cliche. We wanted to really show how sweat looked and, you know, people who didn't have very many things and how the wear was on the clothes. So there were several layers before we even got to the blood.
Right. Yeah. I'm very interested in the ways in which introducing blood to costume design complicates the process.
Yeah.
Because I feel like you've already said that a lot of the scenes in Sinners weren't shot in chronological order in sequence. So were there situations where you had to have blood here, then bring the blood back later? And how does the blood gel? Does it sit? Does it dry?
Yeah,
walk
well,
me through blood continuity.
Blood. We had blood that we collaborated with the makeup department. So when they put blood on the face, the same color would drip onto the clothing. Our wardrobe truck looked like a lab where each section was divided by a sheet of plastic. So you could preserve something that got really, really bloody.
Yeah.
away from the things that were clean.
Mm-hmm.
And also, like Sammy, in the first scene that you see him in walking into the church, we start the film at the end.
Oh, yeah.
And he walks into the church, and he has been through a lot.
Mm.
We shot that first.
Really?
Before the big sequence in the,
oh, wow,
in the pond.
Oh, wow.
So there were a lot of discussions about, you know, where blood landed and what happened, and if it dried up, what that would look
yeah,
like. So you use your imagination and you talk
that
a lot. It's really, you really like cross your fingers that it's all going to puzzle together in
uh-huh,
the editing room.
Well, let me tell you, I liked it.
Thank you.
What was the bigger challenge, sweat continuity or blood continuity?
Oh, sweat. I was out there with water bottles. My crew was out there. I was constantly asking for more sweat because it needed to feel like it was
the South.
South, and it was hot.
And sticky.
And sticky, yeah. And so I think once you get to the blood, it's just how much do you want, you know?
Uh-huh.
And I think like when Mary runs out of the juke and she's getting shot and she's running
yeah,
crazy, you know, we started small and
yeah,
then we made it bigger and bigger and bigger. It's just
yeah,
kind of like how much gore do you want to have
mm-hmm,
in the particular scenes.
When do you know as a costume designer that it's ready, that it's done, that the look is set? Do you have a feeling in your gut?
Oh, gosh.
Do you have a check-in with some colleagues? Like, how do you know? Because hearing you talk about your process, you could spend endless amounts of time learning even more of the history and the intricacies. When
yep,
do you know it's there?
Truly.
Yeah.
I never know it's there. I feel like sometimes I'm escorted off the set. I'm an artist like any other
yeah,
who wants to tweak it up until the moment that the camera rolls.
Okay.
When the camera rolls, I know I'm done.
Yeah.
I can't do any more. It's set. And that's kind of like a blessing
yeah,
because then I get to let go
yeah,
and move on to other things and
yeah,
work on other things. There's so many elements to movie making. The fact that you have set a look and it's been on camera is very gratifying.
Yeah.
And it also gives you time to let go and move on.
Yeah. Yeah. I am very interested in Sinners and your work on Sinners and how it fits into the larger context of your entire body of work.
Ooh.
More than I think any creator of note in this industry, you have very purposefully built a career working in worlds of beautiful blackness.
Mm.
You have done countless movies with Spike Lee. Before Sinners, you did Black Panther 1 and 2. And you build these rich and immersive worlds that are beautifully black. And when I think about your last three big movies, both Black Panthers and now Sinners, they all punched above their weight at the box office, critically acclaimed. But before they were released, people doubted that they could be successful.
Yeah.
Before Black Panther was greenlit at Disney, some Disney executives said, this might be too black to make it.
Mm-hmm.
When Sinners had its first box office weekend of success, all of the industry stories about it were kind of nitpicky
mm-hmm,
and not just saying, wow, good for them.
Mm-hmm.
How does it feel and how do you think about that at this point in your career? You have consistently been part of black art that is very successful. And even still, there are people in this industry that doubt every bit of it.
Yeah, listen, I was groomed by Spike Lee.
Okay.
And in the late 80s, early 90s, when we started at 40 mm-hmm, Acres and a Mule.
Yeah.
And, you know, By Any Means Necessary.
Mm-hmm.
We knew that the Hollywood industry wasn't going to embrace our stories the way that we wanted to
yeah,
tell them.
Yeah.
But someone like Spike, as an artist and a filmmaker and a storyteller and a believer
mm-hmm,
in black culture, kind of set the tone that I think I continue to live by,
yeah,
that my career could be composed of the things that I saw in my community, the things that I felt were important, the experience that I had as a woman growing up in a single parent household, going to an HBCU, moving to California. Like, this was reality for me. And unapologetically, Spike, John Singleton, you know, the up to Ryan Coogler all embody the same edit that this is our story and we're going to tell it our way.
Yeah.
And so.
And black folks can enjoy it and white folks can enjoy it.
Everyone can enjoy it. Because it's real.
There you go. I remember when Black Panther came out, that first Halloween after it, there were so many little white boys and white girls dressed as Black Panther.
Oh my goodness.
And it's like, all right, Hollywood, when will you finally get it?
Yeah, if they could stop, you know, if they could stop the madness. No, but they'll never stop because we're not necessarily in control of it. I think one of the paradigm shifts that happened with Sinners is that, you know, Ryan brought people back to the movies.
Sure did.
All right, listeners, if you're just not joining me, I'm talking with costume designer Ruth E. Carter. You might know her from her Oscar-winning costume design for Black Panther. She's also behind the looks from one of my favorite movies of this year, Sinners.
Take me back to young Ruth Carter.
Oh, okay.
And take me back to the first moment when you said to yourself or someone said to you, costumes.
I was actually at Hampton.
Okay.
You know, as a young girl, I'll go earlier to my years at home as a young girl with a sewing machine in her room.
So you were sewing as a kid.
I was sewing, but I wasn't making anything I wanted to wear or anybody else.
All right, but
except for my next door neighbor, Tommy. He wore my first, like, jacket I made.
Really?
It was like a patchwork jean jacket.
How old were you when you made that?
Oh, I was like 15.
I love that. So you just wanted to sew as a kid.
I just taught myself.
What do you think inspired you to want to sew? Were you seeing certain clothing or certain people in clothes?
I grew up with the two painters, my brothers.
Oh.
So kind of creativity was in our household.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just another way of kind of being creative.
Yeah.
Like, my mother didn't go out and buy me fabric. I went in the attic and, you know, where all the lost clothes go to live forever.
Yeah.
And I would repurpose, which they call it today.
Yeah.
I would repurpose and, you know, make stuff. It
I
was
love
fun
that.
To make stuff.
Describe that first jacket that you gave to your neighbor.
Oh my, it was a blazer.
Okay.
But it wasn't tailored. It was unconstructed.
Yeah.
It was a blazer and I laid out a lot of jeans.
Okay.
So it had patchworks going like vertically around.
I love that.
And I used a Singer pattern. And it fit in perfectly. He loved wearing it too.
I love that.
So I feel like that was my first like confidence booster.
Mm-hmm.
Like this is something you can do.
Yeah. And they'll
and
like
they'll
it.
Like
and they'll
it.
Wear it.
Yeah. So by the time I got to Hampton, I wanted to be an actress and I didn't make a play. And the director, who was the professor, called me to his office and he said, you know, we don't have anyone to do the costumes.
Really?
Do you, you know, there's a costume shop upstairs. I'll give you the key.
Really?
You can go up there, you know, check it out and let me know if you want to do the costumes.
Really?
So I checked it out and I opened up the door to like my learning lab and I never left it. I was known on campus as the costume designer.
Hell
so
yeah.
That was like kind of my place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's incredible. So then you end up linking up with Spike Lee soon after college, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What was your first project with him?
School Days. School Days. Like,
some of these
so
kids are too young to remember. Y'all need an education. Go watch School Days.
Go watch School Days.
It's set in the 80s?
Late 80s, 1989.
Yeah, it's
HBCU.
HBCU, and it's like fraternity sorority wars.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
a musical.
And a musical.
I loved it.
Good and Bad Air.
Yeah.
I Don't Want to Be Alone Tonight. Alicia Keys redid it for her video.
Yeah. And so how do we set up the colors and the vibrant costumes for folks who haven't seen it yet? This is like pre-cross colors, but still very colorful. Yeah. I remember feeling like Letterman jacket energy.
Gamma Phi Gamma.
Yeah.
You know, Dog or Die, the fellas, mm-hmm. the jigaboos, yeah. the wannabes. It yeah. was fun. And I mean, I had just come out of an HBCU.
Mm-hmm.
Spike graduated from Morehouse. Mm-hmm. I went to Hampton. So the idea of it was very familiar. So it was the perfect first film to be on.
Yeah.
Because I think it all came very naturally. I didn't then do like big sketches and stuff, but I did do, you know, because of my college experience, mm-hmm. you know, I did like, I designed all the Letterman jackets and yeah. all the t-shirts, and I did some illustrations for, you know, some building of things. And
yeah.
Yeah. So it was a true experience in filmmaking and mm-hmm. in costume design.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and it felt like that was a showcase for a theme that is a big part of your work. You do a really good job, and I feel like you love putting big, bright, bold colors on black skin.
How do you know that?
Yeah. Yeah. And that is something that I think before you and Spike were doing it, Hollywood
yeah.
didn't know how to do.
They didn't. Everything was gray. Everything
yes.
was subtle. Everything
yes.
was like, you know, don't put colors out there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I always felt like I was learning about color theory. I was learning mm. about color palettes, that mm. I felt color looked great on camera.
Yeah.
And it's also like the late 80s, early 90s.
And everybody was doing color
blocking.
Yes.
And,
yes.
you know, that was the thing. And, you know, lucky for me, because I got to learn, you know, how to tell a story with color. And
yeah.
it took me a while to separate, like, theater and how big and bold that is
mm.
and the film medium and how intense and intricate and small you could be and still, you know, communicate
yeah.
bigly.
Yeah. Bigly. Bigly works. Bigly.
Right.
Yeah.
Bigly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
All right, time now for a break. When we come back, more with Hollywood costume designer Ruth E. Carter. Stay with us.
Support for KQED comes from John Muir Health, offering comprehensive cancer care with a team approach and advanced treatment options at the UCSF John Muir Health Gene and Ken Hoffman Cancer Center in Walnut Creek. And support comes from BART, helping writers discover festive finds and gift ideas at on Bartable, spotlighting places to shop and explore by taking BART. More information on holiday shopping near BART at bart.gov/Bartable.
On the TED Radio Hour, for over two decades, Krista Tippett has been helping her listeners get through change. But she was going through her own life crisis when something unexpected happened.
I fell in love at 64, and it's the greatest thing ever.
That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
The TED coming your way at 4 o'clock this afternoon, followed by All Things Considered at 5.
Would you give up your chance to rule a country for love?
Girls are told from birth. We watch Disney movies. We're told that there's no greater thing than being a princess. But what is the actual reality of that?
Author and journalist Rebecca Armitage on how covering the British royal family helped inspire the heart of her debut novel, The Heir Apparent. I'm Miles Parks. That's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered, it comes your way at 5 o'clock this afternoon here on KQED News.
Hey, y'all, it's the Sam Sanders Show. Let's get back to my conversation with Hollywood costume designer Ruth E. Carter. We've been chatting about her decades-long career and what it's like being one of the few black costume designers in Hollywood. Let's get back into it.
There is a lot of buzz around Sinners, your latest project and your costume work for that. We're entering awards season.
Yeah.
There's Oscar buzz around this movie and everyone's work in it. You at this point are an Oscar veteran, 2-time winner. Does it feel different each round? 'Cause this is now, what, your third round of like contention for a big project. Does it feel different than it did the first time that awards buzz was mm-hmm. circling around you?
Yes, it does. The difference is now I do feel like I'm a veteran in that
yeah.
the journey is not so unfamiliar, and I know I can make choices. And you know, going through the wins was bittersweet.
Really?
I wanted it for Ryan. So being, you know, skirted left and right, and you know, seeing my film family there like cheering me on, but all of us not enjoying a win. I feel like this go round, I'm celebrating an auteur who did original content, original story. I just feel like I am finally going to celebrate the collaboration.
I love
and
that.
That's what feels different about this one. I'm so excited to be, you know, in the company of my, you know, fellow filmmakers, and to celebrate them even more than I could in the first two wins.
All right. So it's going to be a little less stressful this time, maybe.
I hope so.
Yeah. You know, speaking of award season, one of your good friends, from what I hear, recently became the first black man to win an Oscar for costume design.
Yes, Paul Tazewell.
For Wicked.
Yes.
I find it pretty amazing and remarkable that I think y'all are the only two black costume designers that have won Oscars.
Yes.
The only two black Oscar winners for costume design also happened to have been friends for, what, 20 plus years?
Oh, my God. We were both at the Santa Fe Opera at the same time. As interns.
How did he
was in crafts. What? I was in costume.
How did you get to Santa Fe?
We applied.
Okay,
we
was that the place to be?
Well, you had to have a high recommendation to get in.
Okay.
And they only took so many interns.
Yeah.
And there weren't many of us there. I think Paul and I were the only two.
Really? So only two black folks.
Only two black folks.
In Santa Fe, making opera.
Making opera. And I was like, who that black man over there? And he was like, who's she? So it was... We were kind of ships passing in the night, because I was in costumes, he was in craft.
Gotcha. What exactly is craft?
Craft is like he was building the big masks with the feather headdresses and, you know, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it's intense in Santa Fe. And it's like the best training for costumes that, you know, that there is to me. So that's where we both got started. But he kept on the theater path and did the Broadway. I, you know, met Spike and I started to go into film. But I was on the theater path to begin with as well. It's, it's kind of our both of our same origin story.
What is the secret to maintaining a friendship with anybody, especially someone in the same field, that long?
Yeah, well, I've always brought in people into this industry. I've always brought on interns because I believe this film industry is big enough for all of us to enjoy, to be creative, to reap the fruits of our labor, to win awards, if you would.
Yeah.
There is enough room. And, you know, it's kind of naive to think, you know, that, you know, we're at some pinnacle. There's only one seat and we have to kick each other off. There's it's a platform. And I know that, you know, there's Gersha Phillips, there's Antoinette Messon, there's Charlize Antoinette, who just did Children of Blood and Bone.
Yeah.
All of them are on their way.
Yeah.
So it's just a matter of time. We're all going to stand on the platform. It's just an industry that did not embrace us. I mean, going back to the Spike Lee days, there was not enough representation behind the camera.
Oh, yeah.
And he wanted to change that.
Yeah.
And so we all changed that together. I mean, when I walk into studio services at any big department store here in L.A. and I see, you know, a young black girl in there pulling for her show, I feel like I've had something to do with that. And I'm welcoming that because,
that.
You know, there's room for all of us. There's room for all of them. Why wouldn't there be room for all of us?
Yes. I love that you say that, because so many times, and this is a dynamic that I'm sure you've felt, when you are a creative or an employee or a worker or whatever, in a space in which you're the minority, if you are a person of color entering a majority white workspace, there's often this insidious pressure to feel competitive with any other person of color there.
That comes in.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. So that's the kind of
the scarcity mindset that I think
scarcity
these institutions
mindset,
inform us
institutional
with.
Thing
yeah.
that's been put in our heads
mm-hmm.
that you're special, that mm-hmm. you're the only one,
uh-huh.
you're acceptable.
And if they're here, they're taken away from
yes.
your shine. But no, what I
no.
hear you saying is like, one, the pie is big enough. Also, cook us some more pies.
Cook us some more pies, please.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
There is space.
There is space.
You know, not to make it like really simple, but it's like, are you living and working and collaborating in a mindset of scarcity or a mindset of abundance?
Exactly.
And I feel in your work a mindset of abundance.
A mindset of abundance, I think, is the way that you survive,
mm-hmm.
Not feeling othered
mm-hmm.
and not feeling that when something is rejected, that your whole world has,
mm-hmm.
you know, fallen mm-hmm. apart. Like it's abundance. And that means that we can learn from, you know, mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
We can be imperfect.
Mm-hmm.
We can, you know, learn and grow in this industry like anyone else. We don't have to put the stigmas on ourselves that, you know, we're invincible, that,
mm-hmm.
you know, every time we do something, it's going to be an Oscar win,
it's
you
like,
know?
Maybe not. Maybe not, you know?
Yeah, we hope so, but
yeah. We sure do hope so.
Right.
But, yeah.
But I think, you know, Paul showed us that, you know, also, it doesn't have to be a black film.
That
actually, it's an artistic medium.
Come on.
That we could take command of.
Mm-hmm.
It's storytelling. It's
mm-hmm.
craft.
Mm-hmm.
It's artistry.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the next layer that we needed.
Mm.
You know, because I look at Black Panther, the
yeah.
films, you know, I did Seinfeld, I did Ty Cobb, I did
Stop.
Other...
Stop, you did Seinfeld?
I did!
Girl. Stop!
Yeah, I did the pilot.
Which one of them was the hardest challenge to dress?
Well, none of them were really hard.
Yeah. It was very New York, huh?
It's
yeah.
very New York. Jerry, I went to his apartment and picked stuff out of his closet because it was just a pilot. And
yeah.
George wanted to wear the glasses. I've told this story. He wanted to wear glasses. And I still had some leftover pieces from Malcolm X. And he was like, I was thinking I might wear glasses. And I said, well, I have these wire rim glasses. And he puts them on it. They're from Malcolm X.
Wait, stop.
Yes.
In the pilot of
yes.
Seinfeld,
yes.
George Costanza
yes.
is wearing Malcolm X's glasses.
He's not wearing, we're prototype.
Okay.
He put them on. He's like, yeah, something like this.
The inspiration for
yeah.
George Costanza's glasses
yeah.
was Malcolm X's glasses.
Yeah, little did he know.
I love it.
Yeah. But, you know, I was chugging up the path of my craft
yeah.
and my career.
Yeah.
And my career was both New York and in LA
mm-hmm.
and went back and forth,
mm-hmm.
you know, for many, many years. And,
yeah.
So, you know, I think, you know, with Paul training in New York and
yeah.
me training, you know,
yeah.
both coasts, it was, you know, inevitable.
Yeah. And like, in the end, like a testament to the fact that like, a good artist is a good artist that can do anything.
Yeah.
You know? I love black art. You love black art.
Yeah.
We also do all kinds of art.
All kinds of art.
Yeah.
Hey, if you're just now joining me, I'm here with Hollywood costume designer Ruth E. Carter. She's the visionary behind the looks in Sinners, one of this year's biggest and best looking movies.
How long were you the only black woman at your level doing what you were doing? Because I'm guessing it was a while.
So there were a handful.
Okay.
And we all had a different path.
Yeah.
We all trying to make our mark. We
yeah.
all came into it differently.
Yeah.
I just happened to be with both Keenan and Robert Townsend,
mm-hmm.
you know, having done BAPS with Robert Townsend.
BAPS too.
And
yeah.
then going back to Brooklyn and
mm-hmm.
doing Mo' Better Blues and Jungle
yeah.
Fever. So I bounced back and forth. So I
uh-huh.
left Hollywood to go to New York
yeah.
and shoot movies with Spike while they were kind of in the Hollywood
mm-hmm.
circle.
Mm-hmm.
And we all forged our own paths, but, you know, it was just a handful.
Was it harder, worse than folks could have imagined? Were you experiencing really overt sexism and racism, or was it actually not as bad as, I mean, I might have thought it would have been?
I was lucky because I had Spike and Robert and John Singleton to kind of shepherd me. I was in the right spaces to learn. Mm-hmm. And, but it wasn't until like Hollywood started to take notice that I got other offers. Like I said, I did Ty Cobb and Seinfeld and those things. And, I was welcome, but at the same time, you know, there were things that were said that.
Give me an example.
Yeah. I don't want to wear any bright colors.
Ooh. What they're saying is, don't make it too black.
Don't make it too black. Or, you know, Charles Dutton, I did Against the Ropes with Meg Ryan Omar Epps, and Charles Dutton was the director. And he told me, he said, I picked you and the producers picked other people. And, you know, we had a stack of resumes of costume designers and it dwindled down. But every time I got the stack back, your resume was at the very bottom. And I kept having to bring it to the top and say, you know, this is the person who I want. You know, I just feel like, you know, the racism, it's overt because you feel it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's delivered in subtleties.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Industry racism is expertly passive aggressive.
Yes.
They're not going to say the thing to your face, but you're going to know.
You're going
to
know.
You're going to know.
You're going to know.
Do you think that's lessened today? Is
not
thinking
at
better
all.
Now? Say
you
more.
Are you kidding? I mean, I had one producer who will be nameless. he raced over to me after this white actress walked to set in a costume, and he says, "Is that the best you can do?"
Wow. What did you do in that moment?
Well, the actress had already said to me, "I love it."
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. If we love it, let's go for it.
Mm-hmm.
And with that in my mind and in my heart, his words just meant he just flew past me.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah. I know that the world of costume design is pretty separate and removed from fashion and contemporary fashion and streetwear and what we wear.
True.
It is different. It is world building. It is fantastical. It is creating out of nothing. But I do wonder if there is a lesson from the way you think about designing costumes and building worlds with costumes that lay people just getting dressed for their day can apply to their own clothing and aesthetic.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that there are some special qualities in fashion. And I think fast fashion has eliminated the individuality.
That.
And the designer fashion tends to give us what we're not getting in our main world of what's available to us. And I think that's what's shifting. And so as you debate whether you're going to buy that special sweater that might be a little out of your budget, you know that it really is going to be a signature piece for you that you can hold on to for a long time and look deep for those meaningful pieces and make them your own, because, you know, it's not going to be as plentiful and as readily available as you go through your day to day.
I love that. The lesson here is make it meaningful.
Make it happen.
That's allowed. Make it happen.
Yes.
Your clothes tell a story.
Yes, they
think
do.
About your story. Thank you for sharing your wisdom and for truly being the best dressed person we've ever had in this studio. We appreciate you.
No problem.
Yeah. Happy
Thank
awards
you.
Season.
Yay. Thanks.
Alrighty. Thanks again to my guest, Ruth E. Carter, the costume designer behind films like Malcolm X, Black Panther, and Sinners. This show is a co-production between Sam Sanders Productions and KCRW. We are distributed nationally by PRX. If you like what you've heard today, you can find all my interviews on your favorite podcast app
on YouTube and at kcrw.com/Sam Sanders. All right, till next time, be good to yourselves.
The TED Radio Hour, it's coming up next.
PRX.
On KQED Public Radio, we have a SIG alert on the Dumbarton Bridge. Let's find out what it's all about. Steve Herrera.
Yes, hi there, Beth. A special traffic alert for the Dumbarton Bridge. Eastbound 84 after the radio towers, I see a four-vehicle crash with one vehicle with smoke and flames. All lanes are shut down as a result. In San Francisco, southbound 280 before Monterey Boulevard, a five-car pileup is impacting both the right lane and the right-hand shoulder. And a problem in San Jose, northbound 280 connector to southbound 87, a solo vehicle crash blocking the connector ramp. Your stop and go from Vine Street. Steve Herrera, 4KQED.
Okay, thank you, Steve. Traffic support comes from Shen Yun Performing Arts. This week in the Bay Curious Newsletter, a mystery from a San Francisco World's Fair in 1950. Who manufactured the gems that bedazzled the fair's Tower of Jewels? Read that story and so much more in our Bay Curious.